The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
All right, Matt, so I don't know if you heard about this, but there were two cowboys that got lost in the desert. They were wandering the desert and they were starving. Well, finally, one of them sees this tree off in the distance and it looks to be draped in bacon. And so he goes, "Look, it's a bacon tree. We're saved." So they run toward this bacon tree. All of a sudden, they're getting shot with a bunch of bullets. And the other one yells, "That's not a bacon tree, that's a ham bush."
Oh my God. Yeah, I did not see that coming. I was like, where are we going with the bacon tree? Yep,
long setup for that one.
I like it though. I like it. That's a good one.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales. All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
I'm doing good.
Good.
I'm doing good.
So, let me go ahead and get the housekeeping out of the way, and then I got a few things to tell you here in the start of this. First, go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales, sign up to become a patron. We've got several different levels. All the levels, they get a weekly bonus episode you can listen to. They're shorter than the main episodes, but they cover similar topics: weirdness, paranormal stuff, alien stuff, interesting stuff that we can't make a full episode out of, but that we find interesting. And we think you will too. Or if you want our $5 and $10 a month, they get all of that, plus the ad-free audio and video versions of the weekly main episodes. Or go up to $10, you get all that, plus you get our second show, Side Quest. And Side Quest is, I don't know how to explain it, Matt. It's different. It is me and Matt in a different format. If you've ever wanted to hang out with us, and I don't know why you would, but if you've ever wanted to hang out with us and talk with us, that's like the show to listen to, because we're more uncensored, a little freer with our language, and we cover topics that would never fit on Graveyard Tales. So sign up, become a patron, promise you're going to love something over there. We have a huge back catalog of episodes on both the Patreon bonus episodes and Side Quest. We've got a ton of episodes that you can go check out. Also, check out our sponsors. If you check out our sponsors, use our codes, they come back to Graveyard Tales because they know that you heard about them from us, and then they help us out. Also, let's make 2026 a Share the Graveyard Tales year. It's been several years since we have said that, but, you know, Matt and I would really appreciate you guys sharing with a friend who loves paranormal stuff. Share it with an acquaintance. I mean, share it with a random stranger on the street. Share it with an enemy. I don't care. You can hate the person, but tell them about Graveyard Tales and maybe they'll listen.
Yeah, absolutely. So just, you know, run up to them, slap them, say, listen to Graveyard Tales, and then run.
Yep. Listen to Graveyard Tales or I'm slapping you again. But all right, got the housekeeping out of the way. I got to tell you about this, Matt. Now, we came up to visit mom while during the Christmas holidays, and just kind of a break in the fourth wall. This is the first episode that Matt and I have recorded since our Christmas break that we took. So if we're a little rusty, that's why.
Yeah.
It's been a while since we've recorded.
Yeah.
But anyway, we came up there to visit mom, and the Grand Ole Opry had their Christmas shows going on. Well, we were able to, because we have known one of the performers that was on that night, we've known for 30 years, the Riders in the Sky. So we were able to get backstage with the Riders of the Sky. And so we were hanging out back there, getting to watch the Grand Ole Opry from side stage. Very cool. John Party actually played that night. So we got to see John Party. It was fun. But anyway, we were standing in one of the hallways there in the back of the Opry. You know, there's the stage, and then you go a little further back, and there's kind of the room where they got coffee and the artist hang out and stuff. Mm-hmm. We're standing there talking, and I'm partially leaning on this door, partially not. Like, I, you know, lean back for a minute and then step forward. Well, I'm leaning against it. The handle goes down, up, and hits my butt when it comes back up. Like, it actually goes flump. Three of us heard it. Me, my mom, and Ashley all heard this door handle shake. So we all jump and turn, thinking somebody's going to come out of this door.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody comes out of the door. It's a locked closet. So there should be nobody in there.
Huh.
So something shook this door handle enough where we all saw it, heard it, and it hit me.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. And as soon as that happened, I wanted to text you, but I'm like, no, I'm saving that to tell him. So I experienced something, probably a ghost, at the Grand Ole Opry backstage. And
that's really cool.
It is. I didn't even think about it being there. I wasn't in the, oh, there's ghosts here mode. It makes sense because it's been around for so long. But if we have any listeners that have played at the Opry or know people who played at the Opry, have them get in touch with us if y'all have any ghost stories. We want to talk about it.
Now, were y'all at the Ryman or were y'all at the Opry House?
We were at the actual Opry House.
Okay. Okay.
Yep. Yep. Because I knew about the Ryman stuff.
We
covered that. But I didn't even think about the Grand Ole Opry being haunted. But again, it makes sense, like the Ryman.
Yeah, you know? Right.
But the other thing that happened at the Opry, I had to tell you, Michael, and he might kill me for telling this story. He might not. But he's like, I got to go to the bathroom. So we go to the bathroom. I go in and I go to a urinal. Well, he goes to a stall. I go out. I'm sitting there looking at my watch going, dude, come on. I go in there. He had to take a, quote, gnarly poop at the Grand Ole Opry. So he can check that one off his bucket list that he did a doo-doo at the Grand Ole Opry. So I don't know how many people can say that, but Michael is now one of those.
Yeah, right. I bet he's not the only one.
I guarantee you he's not. But on that note, Matt, why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
Okay, so tonight, Adam and I are headed to the outskirts of Homestead, Florida.
Yep.
Which is a town that feels pretty ordinary until you look at one of its most famous landmarks. This is where you'll find the Coral Castle.
Yep.
Which is a monument, essentially, built by one man. Edward Lee Scanlon. And he used thousands of tons of coral rock to build this thing completely by himself.
Mm-hmm.
No heavy machinery, no crews, just Ed and his oddball tools.
Old Odd Ed.
And a story that is absolutely fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So we're gonna dig in to the story of the Coral Castle and talk a little bit about Ed, because
is that a pun?
Yeah, exactly. It's unintended. But Ed was kind of a strange guy.
Yeah.
Had a very unique life and outlook on things. On top of, you know, spending 30 years of his life constructing this massive stone monument.
Right.
But, you know, he's just kind of even his physical stature is a little strange,
mm-hmm.
you know, so,
mm-hmm.
But we think this is really cool. If you've never heard of Coral Castle, you're really going to love this. If you've kind of heard this story, we're going to dig in a little bit deeper than maybe we usually do.
Yep.
You know, so you might think, I heard about that. And, you know, we're going to share some things that we found out that, you know, maybe, you know, may contradict some of the things that you've heard in the past. So,
yeah.
So anyway, let's get to it. Let's discuss Coral Castle. Adam is going to start with the history of Edward Leeds Skalnin. See, I call him Edward throughout most of my notes because I don't want to have to keep trying to pronounce that name.
I was going to say, I'm going to probably call him Ed, Big Ed, or Eddie Pooh or something just to not have to say Leeds Skalnin the whole time, because my tongue has trouble with that.
I know. It's not the hardest name we've tried to pronounce.
No.
It doesn't roll off the tongue well.
So. But I'll tell you, the way I've wanted to say it every time, Edward, Lee, and then Skalnin.
I know.
That's what wants to come out is Lee Skalnin.
And I heard somebody pronounce it to where I was like, is that what he is? Did I miss this? Is his middle name Lee?
Right. Yeah.
Yep. I was like, and then I looked, I was like, no, I had it right. It's just the way this guy's pronouncing it. So.
Yep. But as we always say, go check our sources down at the bottom of the show notes. You can find where we found all the information. You can make sure we're telling you the truth about the information that we found by checking the sources, because everything we talk about is referenced and sourced down at the bottom of our show notes. Now, you may say, guys, you have been doing a show since October 13th, 2017. Why has it taken this long to do the Coral Castle? And I'll tell you, because everybody did the Coral Castle in the first 2 years of their podcast.
Yeah,
and, true. You know, Matt and I, we don't want to follow the same old routine of here are the episodes to expect out of a paranormal podcast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we'll give them to you, but we're going to make you wait for them. That's the thing.
That's it. We're going to make you wait.
Build up the suspense. But Edward Leeds Skalnin, which, like I said, from here on out, it's Ed. He was born to a poor family in what is now rural Latvia. And he was born on January 12th, 1887. Well, he spent most of his early years helping to tend the farmland and keep it growing while also trying to get his education. Well, as with many poor families, especially back then, he only got through elementary school, education-wise. He never went past elementary school in school because he had so much work to do on his farm. And it wasn't great farmland, but they made it pretty mm-hmm. fertile and were able to provide for their family and make a little bit of money. But even though he didn't get much of a formal education, his family actually had stonemasons in his family. So he was said to have learned some stoneworking techniques from these stonemason family members, along with the farming abilities that he got from his dad and immediate family. So it's not like Edward was a dumb guy. He just didn't get a formal education past elementary school. But keep that in mind a little later on, because we're going to get into some stuff that he did that you're going to go, wait, he only went to elementary school? What's this about? Now, the most widespread story about Ed, and you'll hear this everywhere that talks about the Coral Castle, talks about this. When he was in his mid-20s, a lot of people say he was about 26 when this happened. He fell in love with a much younger girl named Agnes Skuvst, S-K-U-V-S-T. Mm-hmm. She's called Annie Skuvst in a lot of reports. So we'll go with Agnes because that's the easiest for me to say. Well, he was madly in love with her, and he had this nickname for her that he used all the time. He called her my sweet 16. Personally, I find this a little gross.
Yeah.
You're 26 and you're marrying a 16-year-old. I realize it was, you know, early 1900s, but I don't care. It's still gross. Sorry. Just Adam's opinion, but I'll move on. Now, they were engaged to be married, but on the eve of their wedding, Agnes broke off the engagement with Ed. Now, Ed was heartbroken. Ed was embarrassed. Well, he couldn't face his family, face his friends with this rejection and heartbreak. And he couldn't bring himself to continue to live around all these people who knew about what had happened. So Ed wanted to get as far away from this embarrassment as he could. So he made a plan to move to America. He felt this was about as far away as he could get from this embarrassment. Now, here's the thing. I was telling Matt about this before we started. There's another theory given for his move to America. Because in interviews that people have gotten with family members of him back years ago, mm-hmm. They all say there was never a sweet 16. There was no broken heart. He didn't have this engagement with a much younger woman who left him, and that was the reason for his move. So the reason for his move in this scenario is it could very well be due to his involvement in the 1905 Latvian Revolution. It was also known as the First Russian Revolution. It was a wave of widespread political and social unrest across the Russian Empire. It was supposedly triggered by economic hardships, defeat in the Russo-Japanese War, which happened 1904 to 1905, and long-standing grievances against the autocratic rule. Now, in Latvia, it was one of the most intense and radical manifestations of this empire-wide upheaval. So beyond class struggle, there was a revolt against dual oppression, Russian imperial rule and Baltic German landlords. So there were the demands that they had included Latvian autonomy, education in Latvia, and land redistribution. Now, the revolution was crushed, but it galvanized Latvian nationalism, and it strengthened socialist organizations, and it foreshadowed the push for independence in 1918, and it also led to mass immigration of political refugees to Europe and North America. Now, Ed's family actually told of his involvement in the revolution actually taking part in killing quite a few government officials. Now,
it's pretty serious, sir.
Very serious accusations here, if this is true. And like I said, I don't know 100% of this is true. I don't think anybody knows. This is just one of the theories given as to why he moved to America that is not the Sweet 16 theory. But during this time, he would have been 18 when the revolution kicked off. Mm-hmm. And his hometown would have been in the middle of the peasant upheaval of the period. And he escaped post-repression purges and arrest by government agents by leaving for America. All right, Matt. So Valentine's Day is coming up. You know what's better than flowers that die in 3 days?
Yeah, I do.
Matching underwear. That's what. Not what you were thinking.
Exactly what I was thinking.
But seriously, MeUndies has cracked the code for Valentine's Day gift with their matching underwear for couples. You know, it's cute, it's intimate, and you'll wear them more than once. And Ashley and I have matching sets from MeUndies. Now, we don't sit there and go, hey, let's wear this today, because that would be a little weird. But we do occasionally go, hey, we're wearing the same ones. And it just happened that way. Like the other day, I bent over and Ashley goes, hey, we're wearing the same underwear. I'm like, hey, I need to pull my pants up.
Yeah, and you're right. You will wear them more than once because I'm still wearing Christmas underwear.
Yep.
And, you know, I probably, if you ask me in July, I probably still. And the reason why is because MeUndies are my absolute favorite underwear. And they make matching underwear specifically for couples. And they are some really adorable prints. And they're different cuts for each of you. Like, you're not going to be wearing the same underwear.
Right.
Yeah, but I don't all
wear thong
made.
Underwear. So.
Yeah, no, you don't.
Not anymore.
What is wrong with you, man? Get on board. You need to get on my level. But all of their underwear is made from their signature ultramodal fabric that feels impossibly soft. That's why they are my favorite, and I will wear Christmas underwear in July.
Absolutely.
Unlike other brands just slapping hearts on generic underwear, MeUndies designs coordinating prints from the ground up. Their Valentine's collection has prints made for two. It's the kind of gift that makes you smile every time you put them on. And their first pair promise, that's 45 days risk-free, means if your first pair doesn't work out, they'll make it right.
Mm-hmm.
No hassle.
That's amazing.
So Valentine's Day is February 14th. So if you want these delivered in time, you need to order soon. This is the gift that keeps giving long after the holidays over. Make this Valentine's Day one to remember with matching underwear from MeUndies. To get exclusive deals up to 50% off, go to MeUndies.com/graveyard and enter promo code GRAVEYARD.
That's right. That's MeUndies.com/graveyard, GRAVEYARD, and use our promo code GRAVEYARD for up to 50% off. So, like I said, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if the Sweet 16 is true. Those are the two reasons given for his move to America. But whichever the reason, Ed left rural Latvia and he headed to mainland Europe and then boarded the SS Pennsylvania that was headed for America. Now, he landed in New York City in 1912, and then he spent the next few years drifting around America and Canada. He was looking for work. You know, he was doing odd jobs at different mills and he was trying to earn money. Well, during the late 1910s, Ed was living in the Pacific Northwest. He had moved to the Pacific Northwest in America because of the logging boom. Well, he worked at a number of different timber mills, and there are records that show he even described himself as, quote, a self-employed axe handle manufacturer?
I don't make axes. I just make the handles.
Just the handle. Yeah. Well, you got to know somebody that's a blacksmith to be able to make the whole axe.
Yeah.
Or you got to be a blacksmith yourself. Well, or
to make the axe whole, right?
That too. Yeah, you got to put the handle through the axe hole. But he knew woodworking because of his years in the lumber business. He didn't know blacksmithing. So he made axe handles. He was shaping the wood for these handles for men whose livelihood depended on the strength of these tools. So he knew what he was doing in making wooden handles.
Mm-hmm.
Now, his time in the wood mills, they say, taught him leverage, pulleys, this kind of knowledge, along with the strength of different woods and how to shape this wood for maximum strength. Plus, like I said, he learned some stonemasonry work from family members. Now, it said that he had so many different jobs during this time because he was a bit of an outcast. You know, he didn't learn English very fast. And living in America, you got to learn English to fit in with the big groups there that were working at the timber mills. Because
mm-hmm.
there weren't many people at the time who spoke his native tongue. So he was kind of an outcast because of that. Well, he kept to himself most of the time. But he actually preferred it that way. He eventually, they say, eventually his body betrayed him. In the early 1920s, doctors told him that he had tuberculosis. And this is a disease that then carried a shadow of inevitability, they say. So the harsh winters and the damp climates where he had lived in the Pacific Northwest no longer was suitable for someone who had lungs like his. So the idea of a warmer place, gentler air, you know, less harsh winters, it really began to tug at him and make him think about moving. Well, stories ended up reaching him about a flat, sun-drenched peninsula at the southern tip of the country, a place where winter could barely even be called winter. And I think we all know that place is Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it was already at this time an escape for Northerners from the cold. Well, this became survival for him. He needed to move to Florida for his TB issues. Now, Ed arrived in South Florida around 1922 or 1923. It's hard to find a specific date on when he actually got to Florida. Now, he ended up making friends with a realtor there, and he bought a small, undeveloped parcel of land for just a few bucks. It was all he had left, but it was right outside Florida City. Now, the land was well away from busy roads and busy towns, and it was a place of solitude for Ed. We know he liked being alone. We know he was a bit of an outcast.
Mm-hmm.
So this was perfect for Ed, a place outside the city, quiet, where he could just be himself. Well, here, the ground was not soft soil like he was used to in Latvia, but there was a bed of pale porous stone called oolitic limestone. It was a material born of ancient seas, they say, which people often called coral rock. Even though it's not truly coral, it's just very porous. Mm-hmm. And when you look at it, it kind of looks like coral. Now, Ed at this time was described by his neighbors as slight of stature. He only stood at around 5 feet tall, and he was very light, maybe 100 pounds, 120 pounds soaking wet, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was a small man. And this comes into play, especially when Matt gets to talking about his part of this, Remember, 5 foot tall, about 100 pounds. Well, he continued his lifestyle of being an outcast, and he lived a very frugal lifestyle and was described as being eccentric by people who knew him. Now, they insisted that Ed was a very sharp man, a very smart man. He wasn't crazy. He was just eccentric. Now, around this time, somewhere in the 1940s, he self-published pamphlets about unconventional ideas on magnetism and electricity. Now, the key titles of these: Magnetic Current in 1945, his main technical work on electricity and magnetism, A Book in Every Home, which was a philosophical and political booklet with personal and often odd advice, they say. He published Sweet 16, which was domestic and political views, reflections that blend his lost love motif with social commentary, and Mineral, Vegetable, and Animal Life. This is short writings about the cycle of life and nature. So, Matt, we got to briefly look at these pamphlets.
Yeah. Yeah, remember I said he was kind of an odd outlook on things?
Yeah, he was an odd bird, as one would say.
Yeah.
Now, his Magnetic Currents pamphlet. In Magnetic Current, Ed argues that conventional science misunderstands electricity and magnetism, claiming that all matter consists of countless individual North Pole and South Pole magnets. He treats electricity and magnetism as two aspects of a single underlying force, his, quote, magnetic current. And he presents a series of home experiments with coils, batteries, iron, and permanent magnets to, quote, prove his model. He rejects standard atomic theory, insisting that real magnets are not electrons and protons, but streams of these individual magnetic particles circulating inside matter and through space. According to his later interpretations, this says he extends this idea into a kind of unified field theory where these individual magnets or cosmic force particles underlie all physical phenomena, even life itself. So, remember I said that he only went through elementary school.
Mm-hmm.
And there's going to be stuff here in a minute that you go, what? He went to elementary and he's what? So this is one of those things. He went through elementary school. Now, he's not a dumb guy. He was not, he was not one of those guys that didn't know anything and just was coasting through life. But you wouldn't think old Eddie Poo would know anything about magnetism and all this stuff, atomic theory and all that, unless he learned it on his own somewhere while working at timber mills.
Right. Especially to be able to say, I don't adhere to many of the current scientific principles.
Right.
If you're going to say you disagree with those principles, you've got to have at least some understanding of them. You know, if you don't have any idea, how can you say that your opinions differ?
Right. Right.
So he had to have done, you know, at least some study into these things, presumably on his own. You know, and most likely as an adult,
yep.
You know, after the age of what, 26, he began to look into these things and develop his own theories.
Yeah. You know, cause
you're right. He may be uneducated in the respect of, you know, the formal education, but He was not an uneducated individual. He had obviously, you know, done plenty of research on these things in order to write his own theory. And even to be able to do that.
Yeah. Yep. Now, in his book, Philosophy, Morals, and Sweet 16, the first one in this is A Book in Every Home. It's a very, very different book than the first one we talked about. Instead of equations and experiments, it offers moral rules, political opinions, and advice on parenting and courtship, which, from a guy who lives on the story that his 16-year-old bride, or bride-to-be, left him at the altar.
Yeah.
I don't know that he's an authority on parenting or courtship. But I don't know. No, most of the stuff in this book had a strict slant to it.
Oh, yeah.
Where you obviously know where he's coming from. Well, he warns about, quote, inappropriate lovemaking, and he worries about the behavior of young people and frames proper conduct almost like an engineer would describe tolerances and limits, as if society were another mechanism that could be tuned, this says. So let's move on to Sweet 16. I'm going to preface this by saying gross. And then,
yeah,
just know, I think this is gross, but I got to tell you about it. He turns repeatedly to the figure of the ideal young woman, the Sweet 16, who clearly echoes the fiance who jilted him. So he mixes romantic longing with prescriptive rules about women's behavior and men's responsibility. The writing, this says, feels intensely personal, yet oddly detached, as if he's trying to systematize his heartbreak into formulas about domestic life.
Yeah.
Like I said, pretty gross stuff.
So, you know, just to give you an example, okay, within Coral Castle, he has an area that is dedicated to discipline, okay? And he says that, you know, bad behavior cannot be tolerated and must be punished. So there's actually an area set aside for this in Coral Castle. And the description of it, he basically built a stockade, okay?
Yeah.
Where he said, you know, for children, but even his Sweet 16, if she sassed him too much, said he would take care of it by putting her in here, okay, head and hands, putting a large piece of wood down, and then he said spending an hour with his counsel would fix the behavior. Like,
now here's
what?
Here's a theory, Matt. Perhaps if the Sweet 16 tale is true, and that's why he left Latvia, maybe this is the reason.
Yeah, perhaps.
Because she heard him talking like this and she went, nah, dude. No. Like, ain't know, no way.
I may you're only be 16, but I'm bigger than you are. Right. You're not going to put me in a damn stockade.
Right. Right. You know? I'm 5'6". What are you going to do? Yeah. Like I said, it's gross. But that was one of his books, so we need to talk about it. Now, the last book to talk about is the Mineral, Vegetable, and Animal Life book.
Yeah. I didn't know minerals were alive, but okay.
Oh, yeah. They are. Now, Ed sketches his view of life cycles through the mineral, plant, and animal kingdoms. He treats living systems as arrangements of his fundamental magnets, suggesting that adding or redirecting magnetic currents can change what a living thing is capable of doing. Now, later commentators highlight that he thought of his, quote, individual magnets as a universal substance or, quote, real life, that builds and connects everything, from stones to stars to people. So this lets him drift between topics. They say he goes between cosmology, biology, and mechanics, and he makes bold speculative connections that mirror the way Coral Castle itself blends engineering symbolism and his personal myth.
Yeah.
So this dude, he's on some things. Now, I don't want to say he's on to some things, because I don't think he's on to much with these books, but he's on a kick about something.
Yeah, yeah.
And I want to reiterate, he was not dumb. He was a smart guy.
Yeah.
He had some very strange views. He was eccentric, as his neighbors said.
And even if modern science, or even science at the time, proved him to be incorrect about a lot of these theories, when we talk about how he constructed Coral Castle, you begin to wonder, did he have some kind of knowledge that maybe science can't explain? Because,
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
I mean, you really begin to wonder, maybe he was onto something, at least with this stuff. But
right.
I don't know. I think by the time we get to the end of this, you'll understand this. But I think this was his end goal, to be honest, is just to make this thing as mysterious as he possibly could.
Yes. Yeah. I think you're right in that. I think the goal was to have an air of, basically, he didn't know it was going to be two idiots sitting behind a microphone talking about him.
Right.
Decades down the line. But he wanted to be talked about.
Oh, yeah.
He wanted to be controversial in his work and his writings and make a name for himself. And I even if the name is only in the weird sects of community that you and I inhabit, he still made a name for himself because everybody in our realm knows the Coral Castle.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So...
Now, while in Florida City, Edward began to quarry out the stone by himself, using it to build his house along with other things like rocking chairs. Okay, actual stone rocking chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, tons of stone.
That actually rock.
Yeah, yeah. Tons of stone was moved by Edward without the assistance of heavy machinery or crews of workers, and he worked mostly at night, leaving his neighbors perplexed as to how he managed to move these stones all alone.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever he was asked, his response would be, quote, "I understand the laws of weight and leverage, and I know the secrets of the people who built the pyramid." Now, he called this place Rock Gate Park, okay? Now, in 1937, Edward moved all the stones to their final home in Homestead, Florida, which is, what, about 45 minutes to an hour outside of Miami.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Now, one of the stories as to why he moved them was that he learned that they were building a subdivision right there close to where his property was. And he didn't like that necessarily. So he was going to move, you know, just down the road, essentially, to Homestead and move all of these rocks. I don't think anybody is 100% sure, because there's still a lot of theories as to, did he move these in order to line them up with,
right,
you know, celestial bodies, ley lines, whatever, and we're going to get more into that.
Yep. There's also the theory I heard that there was a price issue with his land, and he actually, being a recluse.
Yeah.
Even though he was a recluse, he wanted people to see it.
Yeah.
And being where he was, he got so far out of the main towns that he couldn't,
he wasn't generating enough traffic.
Right.
Yeah.
So he moved to be closer to where people could get to him, and it would actually help pay for his land.
Because he only charged 10 cents to see it. I mean, it wasn't like he was, you know, becoming a wealthy man doing this.
Yep.
But that speaks more to the fact that he was more interested in people seeing it and experiencing it than he was at getting rich.
Right. Because there were even stories that said if you went to him and said, man, I don't have a dime, he'd go, ah, come on.
Yeah. The sign is still there. You know, the rock, the stone sign that says 10 cents is still there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as if building Rockgate Park wasn't amazing enough, more mystery was added to the story with the feat of moving all of these stones.
Mm-hmm.
No one is 100% sure how he accomplished this, but the story says that Edward rented a truck, and when the driver wasn't looking, he had already loaded all of the stones himself.
Yep.
Now,
it was like, hey, yeah, go around the corner and you can take a pee. That's sure.
Yeah. And then the guy comes back and all these stones
are on
the truck.
You hear. And then you turn the corner and everything's loaded already.
Yeah. You're like, what?
How did that happen?
And there are two teenagers that claim to have witnessed Ed levitating the stones as if they were balloons. Now, later on, when author Rusty McClure was working on the book Coral Castle, he attempted to track down these eyewitnesses, but unfortunately, both of them had passed away. But he did reportedly speak to one of the witnesses' sisters, and she claimed that her brother swore, quote, to his dying day, that he saw those big slabs floating in the air.
Man,
it's really weird.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
You're a kid riding your bike down the street or whatever. You look over and the weird dude that your parents have said, man, that guy's a little odd. He's nice, but you might not, you know, you might stay away from him. You see this dude levitating rocks.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, that would, like some Legend of Zelda thing where he's just setting them on this truck.
And it's funny you say that. I'm going to jump in here, Matt. If you got this later, I'll cut this out. Okay. But you making that noise made me remember there are stories of hearing him whistling he's working.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right.
There's stories of people saying they heard, and not like a song, but like he was whistling tones where he would just go for, and there you hear that and you're like, what is this dude whistling for?
Yeah. Yeah.
And was he whistling?
We're not necessarily that, but we are going to talk about the idea of he possibly used harmonics to move these stones, which is, I mean, it's cool idea, but I don't, I'm not smart enough to know how to do it.
No, but that's why I wanted to drop that in if you didn't have it, just to have people thinking.
But this idea that he somehow levitated these stones, it is the underlying mystery of this story. Okay. The whole concept that he somehow managed to use whatever, you know, power that he had managed to harness to move these tons of stone himself without any assistance or any big machinery. Okay. Mm-hmm. That the somehow he was able to float them around. That is the story that gets tied to Coral Castle. But a man named Orville M. Irwin, who wrote the book, The Death of Mr. Kant, C-A-N apostrophe T. He was friends with Ed, and he claims to have been the truck driver that carried the stones to Homestead. Now, he says that Edward did indeed load all of the stones himself and would turn away anyone that was offering to help, but that it took him several weeks to do so. And in fact, the entire move took most of the year. So the accepted story does seem to hint at Edward floating these stones onto the truck in a matter of minutes. But that really doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah.
It's just kind of been, it's kind of been the legend that goes along with this. But according to Orville Irwin, in his book, he lays out how Edward did it, you know, and it's not by using magic or magnets or harmonics or anything else. And, you know, he did it, and he did it by himself, which was an amazing feat in and of itself.
Mm-hmm.
But it took him a long time. And Irwin makes a comment in the book that Edward had like zero concept of time. You know, that he worked on his own timeline, and it did not matter how long it took, that this was what he intended to do, move these stones by himself. And so that's what he did, no matter if it took a few days, a few weeks, or a few years. That's what he was intent to do. So that, and you know, there's some inference as to this is why he worked at night. It wasn't necessarily that he was keeping it secret. It's just that's when he was awake and wanting to work.
Yep. Well, and my thing has always been, it's Florida.
Yeah.
If you can work at night,
that's way better.
It's not as hot.
Yes.
So I would work at night in Florida too, if I had to do that.
But you know, my thought is we're talking about the 1920s and 30s. How available was enough light to actually be able to work in the dark? I mean, I can go to Walmart and buy, you know, a set of lights, work lights that are thousands of lumens strong.
Mm-hmm.
And basically turn my backyard into, you know, daylight for less than $100. That technology wasn't available to him. So if he was working at night, he was working in the dark, you know, at least, you know, darker than you would expect somebody to be working.
Yeah, he was working in the dim at very least.
Yeah, you know, if he's got, you know, some lanterns or, you know, a few electrical lights, they sure weren't powerful. You know, they weren't like, you know, 2,000 lumen lights, you know, or anything like that. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, it was dim probably at best. So once he got everything to Homestead, the name of the place changed from Rockgate Park to Coral Castle. Edward opened his castle to the public for tours, again, charging only 10 cents. And visitors would come up and they would ring a little bell, and Ed would emerge from his little castle and take guests on the tour. So not only do you get the tour for 10 cents, you get the tour from the guy that built it.
Yep.
So that would have been amazing in and of itself, you know?
Yeah. It's just funny to me that you ring a bell and then he just, the comes image I out. Have is Homer coming out of the bush. You know how Homer just emerges from the bush?
Yeah.
That's the image I have of him just coming out of his castle. Just, hey.
Or like the Simpsons parody of Dracula when, you know, Burns is Count Dracula and he just kind of shows up and then that's odd, the blood usually gets off on the second floor. You know that people are looking down at this little man going, you're weird.
yep Eccentric is a good word for you.
But for visitors, there was so much more to see than just a bunch of heavy rocks situated in various positions. One of the most unusual features of the castle was a large revolving door made from a single slab weighing approximately 9 tons.
this fascinates
This is why, regardless of how Edward pulled this off, this is what makes it amazing.
Mm-hmm. The engineering is insane.
It was perfectly balanced on a plate that sat on the ground. And using only one hand, a person could easily rotate the slab 360 degrees. In fact, there's actually video from like the 60s or 70s of a woman talking about it, and she's just pushing this thing around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, one-handed. Mm-hmm. They talked about a child could do this.
Yep.
Now, after Ed died, the door seemed to stop working. And as the story goes, the University of Florida Engineering Department was asked by the National Historic Registry to come and see if they could fix the door. The engineers took the door apart and discovered that the slab was balanced atop a Ford Model A truck axle.
Hmm.
A team of guys using a crane attempted to lift the slab back into place. The weight of the slab was actually bending the crane. The crew could never get it to balance the same way that Ed had done all by himself.
Can you imagine the looks on their faces?
I know.
When that starts, that just their flabbers were gasted at that point.
I mean, the bearings, there was the bearings from this Model A at the bottom, and then the truck axle went up through the center. So as if they couldn't, this whole crew with a crane couldn't get this door balanced the same way.
Mm-hmm.
They were baffled at the precision of the hole that was drilled down through the center of the slab. That's what the axle passed through. That's what allowed it to rotate.
Right.
Which it said one of the engineers commented that there was no way anyone could drill a hole that perfect without a laser.
Well, they did.
He did. I mean, he did. He got it in there somehow.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like this is not like when they go back and they're talking about the pyramids or Machu Picchu and they go, it would be almost impossible for them to balance this in such a way with the tools that we know. Okay. That's a lot of speculation. This we know. Not only that it was done, we know who did it, and that he did not use any of these, you know, large, technologically advanced tools. So he actually did it. How he figured out how to do it and do it with such precision, we don't know. But just imagine a 9-ton slab of this coral rock, this limestone, that he managed to figure out how to drill a hole perfectly down so that this door would balance. Rusty McClure, who wrote the book, The Coral Castle, I mentioned earlier, he tells a story about the stone that served as the base for the axle. Now, according to McClure, the engineers realized that the weight of the slab and the axle would have ground this coral limestone into dust. It would have just ground it up. Mm-hmm. This stone is not super hard. Okay.
No, that oolitic limestone.
Yeah. And so that's why you see it in parking lots and driveways and front yards, just because it gets crushed down by vehicles and foot traffic and whatever over time, it just becomes like gravel, mm-hmm. almost into sand. But this stone was intact. So They reportedly sent it to the geology department at the University of Florida to determine what type of stone it was. And according to the story, the results were inconclusive, causing the geologist to say that it was, quote, material not of this earth. Yeah.
Hmm.
Now, unfortunately, there are no records at the University of Florida to verify this story, nor are there any names of anyone who was involved in the testing. And, you know, any professors or geologists that would have done this testing are long gone now.
Right.
So they're not, you know, you're walking around, hey, does anybody remember this guy, Ed, that built the coral castle? No, no.
Yep.
They don't. Right. But that stone is there with a sign that says material not of this earth. And I mean, this thing is intact. You can see yep. the divot in the top where the axle would have sat down on top of it. How
Crazy.
On earth did yeah, he manage to pull this off? By himself or not? How did he manage to pull this off?
We don't right, know. That's the thing. Whether it's just one man or a team.
Yeah.
How did
yeah,
they do
how would
that?
They have done it? Now, beyond the stones and their positions, there are other marvels at Coral Castle. Ed carved a stone telescope. And he even erected large stone depictions of Jupiter, Saturn, and the moon from blocks weighing as much as 23 tons.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for the most part, each carving and piece is made from a single stone. The tallest stones reach 25 feet, while the heaviest rock weighs nearly 30 tons. 30 tons.
And just, it's mind-boggling. You can't think of something that heavy.
Right.
Like,
so I'm just like, look, you know, you wonder, well, how do you manipulate something that weighs 30 tons by yourself? You know, and we're going to get into that, but some of these tools that Ed used, that he built them himself. I mean, he repurposed so many things and just created tools to get his account. But my thought is, how in the heck do you do something like this with just tools you built, like from a junkyard? What?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
yep.
You know, well, you're moving stuff around. Okay. You build you a little tripod, you know, so you can lift the stones. You don't got to lift them real high. You just got to get them off the ground. Okay. This thing weighs 30 tons. What?
Yeah.
I don't care what kind of leverage you're using. 30 tons. Mm.
30 tons. Now, think about that. To help you visualize, 30 tons, that's about 7,000 small dogs. Just to, if that helps you visualize.
If that helps, you know, because we've all got that reference in our brain.
Right,
of what 7,000
right.
dogs look like.
You're welcome.
So, the average weight of the stones is about 14 tons or 3,500 dogs.
Yeah, right, right. 3,500 small dogs.
But with these huge rocks, Ed built walls. He erected a tower and a 22-ton obelisk. He made a variety of furniture, including beds, rocking chairs, a bathtub, a fountain, tables. I built a well, sundial, and a throne. Well, it's a castle. You got to have a throne, for crying out loud.
I kind of want one of the thrones.
And one of the funny things was he built this, like I told you, he built those rocking chairs. And Adam said, they really rocked. And they do.
Mm-hmm.
But he built one chair that didn't rock, and the seat of it was not deep enough. It was like a little too shallow, and it sat straight up. If you've ever yeah. sat in a chair that the seat was just not deep enough, how uncomfortable it is, because you kind of feel like you're sliding forward. The story is that this chair was for his mother-in-law.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Yeah. Okay. So Ed had a sense of humor, you know?
Or I'm going to make a mother-in-law's chair.
Yeah. And now he used no joint compound or mortar. The massive stones, when combined together, are held in place by their own weight. And they are so well constructed and heavy that during the Category 5 Hurricane Andrew in 1992, none of the stones shifted. The 8-foot wall was not affected and remains to this day uniform height around the perimeter. Buildings Coral Castle after Hurricane Andrew were demolished. Okay? Mm-hmm. Coral Castle was unfazed. Category 5 hurricane.
It was fine.
Yeah.
It was like,
I mean,
Category 5, more like Category 0.
Yeah. He was like, listen, he said, I prepped all these stones by whistling at them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So no hurricane is going to blow my house down.
I hummed my special tune. So
I'm telling you what, if the three little pigs had known Ed, they'd have been living high on the hog.
Yeah. But up bump.
Now,
high on the wolf or something.
Now, as I said, Ed built a well. Okay. He used dowsing rods to dig this well, to find a freshwater spring, which, you know, if you know anything about Florida, freshwater is in short supply. You know, when we're talking about, you know, somebody actually finding digging a freshwater well, it's not everywhere.
It would have been more than luck is what you're saying.
Yeah. And he used the dowsing rods. And then with this well, he was able to build a hand crank pump that with this water essentially created his own electrical power plant. And he did all this with a third grade education.
Yep. Yep.
Pretty impressive.
Pretty amazing. Yeah.
So now we've kind of talked about, you know, what Coral Castle is, you know, the structures that are there and the marvels of Ed being able to do this completely on his own. And there are a lot of unanswered questions, but there are also a lot of theories as to how he did it, why he did it, you know, so on and so forth. So we're going to dig in to the who's and whys and hows of Coral Castle.
Yeah, so there's been a lot of people that have taken stabs at trying to explain how Ed built the Coral Castle over the years. And most engineers and historians think that Ed used well-understood techniques, careful planning, simple machines, and a lot of time to get it done. So one of the things that Matt didn't touch on was there was one piece of equipment that he had that everybody talked about, and it was a tall tripod with a black box on top.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Go ahead. 'Cause I've got more on the black box.
Okay. And one of the things these engineers say is this tripod was built from large timbers, but you didn't see, he showed you the black box, but you didn't see the chains, the block and tackle, the winches and pulleys that he learned how to use from his timber days, mm-hmm. and that he made, you know, from old car parts and scrap metal that he used to lift these stones. But my thing is, well, then where was it when he died? If he had all this stuff around, why do we not have a box of it?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And they do have some of that stuff, but not at the level you would have expected, you know?
Right. For what he did.
And like in Ed's workshop, there's all of these tools that he made himself, like there's an engine block that mm-hmm. is stuck inside a stone.
Yep.
You know, he built these odd perpetual motion machines. Why or how he used them, we're not really sure.
Right, right. And they say that this oolitic limestone, because it's fairly porous and lighter than it looks, then if you have enough mechanical advantage, then a single skilled worker can move multi-ton blocks by combining levers, ramps, wedges, and counterweights. Here's my argument for that, Matt. I don't care how light the stone is comparatively. It's still a 30-ton block.
Okay, yeah.
The weight is the same. I don't care how light you say this stone is versus, granite.
Exactly.
30 tons of granite is the same as 30 tons of oolitic limestone.
That's, yeah.
It's still 30
That's
tons.
That's my thing. It's the old riddle, you know, which weighs more, a pound of lead or a pound of feathers? It's mm-hmm. still a pound, no matter what the material is.
It's a pound, yeah.
You know.
So don't give me that, oh, they can, but the stone's lighter, so they can. Okay, yeah, if it was the size, and you're going just off the size, then yes, it would be easier to move oolitic limestone than it would be to move granite.
Yeah.
But we're not going by the size of the piece. We're going by the poundage
exactly,
of
yeah.
the piece.
Yeah, right.
So the poundage is the same. Now, can it be done? Sure.
Uh-huh.
But the crane almost bent. This is a man who did not have a crane. He had wooden tripods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, they do say that they have old photos of surviving tools at Coral Castle that show tall wooden gantries, hoist, mm-hmm. rigging, that support the idea that he relied on classic stone masonry and logging camp methods that he already learned from his previous life.
Yeah.
That's fine. I'll give you that on most of this stuff. But 30 tons.
Yeah.
How did wooden gantries, log tripods, move these huge tonnage of rock
mm-hmm.
when a modern crane was bending under the weight?
Yeah, right, right. And, you know, one of the theories on how he was able to accomplish this is, it's pretty simple, like Adam said, the tripod, and that he had this almost like a rolling crane that was like a large engine hoist, okay? So that you could lift it up and then roll it, okay? And he would put chains around the stone, roll the crane into place, and attach the chains to the crane's hook, and use a lever and counterbalance to lift the stone from the ground. Now, the counterbalance was a large sack that he would fill with water. And he had a pump that would pump the water into the sack. And once the water outweighed the stone, using this system of levers and gears and pulleys, then it would lift the stone up, and then Ed could roll the stone into place, which I'm like, that's good in theory,
mm-hmm.
but he still would have to roll something that weighs 30 tons.
Right. Think of it this way too, Matt. You've got the counterbalance on it.
Yeah.
So at that point, the whole system weighs 60 tons.
Yeah, right.
Because if you've got a counterbalance that weighs more than the rock, yes, that will lift it.
Yeah.
That's a duh thing.
Yeah.
Yes, it will lift it. But if it's all attached to this rolling engine hoist, then he has to roll almost double more than double the weight of the rock wherever he's going. Now, I dare you to find me three timbers that will hold up 10 tons, let alone 60, 65 tons of weight to do it. And I say again, yes, this works in theory, like you said, but where is the machinery? Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And
where is it? Because if he had all this, it would have been there when he died.
And it was Archimedes that said, give me a lever long enough and a fulcrum on which to place it, and I shall move the world. Edward would have had to have a long ass lever, okay, to lift something this size. And that black box that Adam mentioned, it's in so many of the photographs and the films that they took, that some people actually have made comparisons to ancient glyphs from like Egypt and Mesopotamia that show these images of these tools and a box, mm-hmm. you know, along with these tools. And it's led people to speculate, was this kind of the key to the use of magnetics or harmonics or acoustic levitation, you know, to get these stones into place? And, you know, we know, I'm afraid I'm getting ahead of myself, but, you know, Adam mentioned the black box. So the black box is real, but they don't really understand how he used it and what its significance was. And some people believe that this may have been what was used to build the pyramids, you know, what was used to build a lot of these other ancient wonders, because it was the key to understanding, you know, how to manipulate energy.
Right.
So,
right.
So, you know, we talking about this is the physical aspect of how he would have pulled it off. But let's get into the other ideas of how he might have pulled this off.
Right. Because there's a lot of people that point to that quote where he said, I know the secrets of the people who built the pyramids. Mm-hmm. So that spurred a lot of exotic theories that really, I mean, Matt, let's be honest. The exotic theories are why we've done this episode.
Exactly.
If it wasn't for this, this would have been a side quest episode where I just told you a cool story about a 5 foot tall guy that used levers and made a coral castle. Yep. But there are writers who claim that he discovered a way to overcome gravity by using magnetism or earth energies to reduce effective weight of stones. And it was inspired by his own magnetic experiments and devices like his perpetual motion holder that Matt mentioned. Mm-hmm. And if this is true, let's think about this as true. Okay, he used magnetism and earth energies is what they're saying. He wrote an entire pamphlet on magnetism. Mm-hmm. And he said all life, even in his other pamphlets, are made up of basically tiny little magnets. We're all just magnets lined up in a certain way. If that is true, then yes, you can figure out a magnetic pull or a sequence of magnets to lift things. Because we know you put a magnet under something and it'll raise it up. You put a magnet above it, it might lift it up or push it down.
Yeah.
I mean, Ashley has on her desk at work, she has a floating TCU helmet. That's just a helmet with magnets in it sitting between two different magnets. Mm-hmm. And it floats there in between them and spins. So if everything is magnetic, like Ed says, you can do something similar and find the correct magnetic frequency, get it between these things and just slide it over. And then weight has no effect at that point.
Right. But that in that perpetual motion holder, I mean, it is, it's that same principle. It's, you know, two coiled wires, each having its own terminal and current, and connected each other nose to tail in a current. And that what the idea is that you complete that circuit and these individual magnets, you know, they form into one of two currents and the currents chase each other in a never ending loop. So mm-hmm. it's constant motion. So it produces the power that he would need to do this. You know,
right.
it's amazing, but this was what he called perpetual electromagnetic energy. And you know, that's where a lot of modern science comes in and goes, you know, he's got this wrong. This is really mm-hmm. not how this works. But yet, he accomplished it, at least in theory. And other people have supposedly built these perpetual motion machines, these engines that will, you know, reabsorb their own energy to fuel themselves mm-hmm. to continue to go, you know, so
right.
basically creating, you know, this everlasting
gobstopper, yeah,
everlasting movement, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's mm-hmm. you know, the interesting thing about all of those people that supposedly developed those engines, they all met very strange demises.
You know, right, it's weird.
Yeah,
huh?
that's for another show. But
yeah,
even sure we'll do that show because I'm kind of nervous about talking about it.
100%. I was about to say the same thing. One, you and I had talked about this before we started recording, Matt, and you got stuff on it. I teased to it when I said that there were stories of him whistling different tones.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Now, I don't know how many of y'all have heard of cymatics. Cymatics, basically, is put sand on a plate, put that plate on top of your subwoofer, play different tones through it. They have actually found out that the different tones that you play will create a predictable pattern in the sand. Mm-hmm. So if you play, I'm just making this up, but if you play a low B flat, then the B flat tone will create a star shape on the sand. Or if you play a C or a C sharp, you'll get a mandala type look where it's spirally and different patterns and stuff in there. So one of the theories that was put to the ancient pyramids is this same theory mm-hmm. that it was a harmonic resonance. And Matt and I have talked about this many times before in previous episodes, but harmonic resonance moving objects. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and, you know, that the harmonic resonance and acoustic levitation,
mm-hmm.
you know, combining to be able to move these heavy stones and put them into place. And we know that acoustic levitation is real. Modern physics experiments show that with the use of sound waves, small particles can be locked into space
mm-hmm.
by shooting waves at a specific frequency that creates these air pressure points so strong that they cancel out the effects of gravity.
Right.
But
think about it this way. The air is technically a fluid.
Yeah.
If you push waves through this fluid at a certain frequency or at a certain sound is just waves in the air at a certain interval. Mm-hmm. So up and down, up and down. If you do it at the right frequency, those waves will hit the object at an interval that will keep it up.
Yeah.
It will lift it and keep it up because air's basically a fluid. Just get that in your head. You're breathing water right now. Not really. But it that is the simplest layman explanation on why this works. So that's how I, my dumb butt thinks
about
it.
That's pretty accurate. I mean, you're basically creating these using frequencies. You're basically canceling out, but then creating these waves that hold pressure. And so scientists have been able to basically float a little particle in midair on these pressure points. But these are very small particles. And the sound waves that would be required to move something the size of the stones in Coral Castle would be so strong, they would be unbearable to humans because they would create forces with the strength of earthquakes. Okay? Mm-hmm. So the idea that this was somehow how he did it, it doesn't seem possible because there's nobody talking about this little 5-foot dude creating earthquakes in his backyard.
Right. Or the sound waves, we know that when an explosion happens, there's pressure waves in the air. And a lot of damage is done by pressure waves. We have guys that have come back from Afghanistan with TBIs from standing too close to a breaching charge on a door. So it's just a small explosion that blows open a door. They were too close to it, but the pressure of that sound wave and pressure going through the air hit them and caused traumatic injury to their physical body. If he's creating a sound at a level that is strong enough to lift 30 tons, what would that do to his 5-foot-tall, 100-pound body?
Yeah, right.
What kind of damage
would
that do?
It would crumple it up.
Right.
You know, it's just, it's unbelievable. And when you, if you get the opportunity to visit Coral Castle, it's amazing in and of itself. Just even if you just look at it as like an art installation, you're like, man, this is really cool. It's just, you know, because there's so much in there. There's damn Masonic symbols in there. There's, you know, images of celestial bodies. There's just, it's set up on the cardinal planes.
Yep.
For some reason, we don't know. There's even, you know, a story that the front door of the castle is lined up with the point of the Bermuda Triangle. What? I mean, it just goes on and on. So if you just look at it for what it is, you're like, man, this is pretty cool. But then when you really start to, you know, scratch away the surface and go, how did this guy manage to put all this together by himself, regardless of if you think, oh, there was some kind of trickery or magic or magnetism, or he has some, you know, black box that could do it. Regardless, he did it. I mean, he did it. Even if he used nothing but self-made pulleys and gears and tripods and whatever, he did it. And it is absolutely incredible that he managed to do it. I heard one guy say, understand it took him 30 years to do it. You can get a lot done in 30 years. That's true. But the fact that this man dedicated 30 years of his life to this and the accomplishment that he achieved, it's still, I mean, it is just, it blows me away. So.
Yep. And here's my conclusion, synopsis, whatever, of this whole episode. The Coral Castle is awesome. Like Matt was saying, no matter how he did it, whatever. But even though it's awesome, we know next to Jack about how he did it, why he did it, or even why he came to America. Mm-hmm. So basically, we know nothing. At the end of this episode, we have taught you nothing. And hopefully that's okay.
Yeah, that's right.
But it's very interesting. It's a really cool place. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that we will ever find out exactly how Ed did this.
Yeah, I don't either. But we may be able to learn more about what we would be able to do by looking into what Ed was able to accomplish, you know, because these experiments are leading toward that, you know. Mm-hmm. Here's an example of how one individual was able to do this. We don't understand how he did it, but we have some ideas of what he may have done. And we can now test those theories and test, you know, the physics of those actions to see. And maybe we learn about that from this. So,
right.
Man, I tell you what, we run long on the shows that we really are more passionate about, yeah, you know? Right. And it has been a long time coming, but I'm glad we finally got to it. We appreciate you listening so much. Don't forget to go and check out our website, which is graveyardpodcast.com. And there you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise. You can listen to the show and you can become a patron. And thank you so much to everyone who has donated to the work that Adam and I do. We appreciate it so much. It's why we are still doing this in 2026. Don't forget to rate and review us on whatever podcast, format you use, but on Apple iTunes, it brings us up the chart. So it makes it easier for people to find the show, which just brings more people into the graveyard.
Yep.
So until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.